presented in the public interest. This is the program that brings you, for the first time on the air, a nationwide manhunt in action. This is the program that has led to the capture of three dangerous criminals. From the record, hear the on-the-spot reports of the people involved. Real names are used. Nothing is withheld. No one is protected. Here are the dramatic eyewitness accounts of a man wanted. Wanted for armed robbery.
And now, Wanted's on-the-spot investigator, Walter McGraw.
Good evening. Once again, you and I are going on a manhunt for a criminal who is now at large in this country. I'm going to take you into homes, factories, farms, into gang hideouts and penitentiaries where you will meet the actual people, not actors, who are involved in this fugitive's activities. They'll talk directly to you, telling their own stories in their own way. Remember, each and every one of these people are putting themselves on the spot to give you first-hand information about a man who is wanted. Tonight, we're turning Wanted Spotlight on the newest addition to the ranks of the FBI's top 10. This time, you will hear the fantastic career of a tattooed criminal with a double identity. So listen, these are the facts.
The date, August 11, 1924. The location, Jersey City, New Jersey.
The voices you hear next are the voices of the actual people who, through no fault of their own, are involved in the case of FBI number 1884791.
This is Chief Jim McNamara of the Jersey City Police Department. Jersey City was plagued with a series of early morning holdups in the downtown part of the city. My partner and I observed a couple of suspects walking along. They didn't look too good. They looked like as though they may be out to do a job. We proceeded to apprehend them, which we did. After searching these suspects, we found several pieces of jewelry, some watches and cufflinks. They identified themselves as John Butkus and Tommy Kling, both of Bayonne. And after questioning Tommy Kling for several minutes, he refused to give us any information. But his partner, who was more of the softer type, he did admit that they committed a lush job in Bayonne. What I mean by a lush job is where they roll a drunk and take his valuables, and where he needs a little clout to keep him from hollering copper, they give it to him. We proceed to fingerprint Tommy Kling. As we started to print Kling, I observed a snake coming down his sleeve, which was not a live snake, but a tattoo mark. As we proceed to roll up the sleeve, more tattoo marks appeared, right up to the shoulder. We then rolled up the other sleeve on the left arm. Tattoo marks appeared right up to the top of his left shoulder. He had the Rose of No Man's Land, to Mother, Bleeding Heart, Hands Across the Sea. On his chest he had Spread Eagle, a ship. He was the most tattooed man I ever did see outside of a freak in a circus.
The non-talkative 18-year-old Tom Kling and his partner were charged with larceny from person. He was tried, found guilty, and placed on probation. Kling, his feelings hurt because he had been picked up as a suspect in a plague of robberies, when in truth he had committed only one, felt Jersey owed him some lush jobs. He went to work and collected that debt. In the 10 years that followed, Kling was implicated in over 30 petty thefts.
The Jersey police finally got him and sent him away. 3 to 5 years in Rahway Reformatory.
You should have seen Tommy when he arrived. A kid, you know, from hunger. But he's a listener, Tommy is. He listened to the big guys and learned to lay off that petty stuff and to get in with the gang. He learned his lessons in a hurry. He had to. You see, he was only in Rahway 1 month.
1 month after his confinement, Thomas Kling cracked out. And he was wanted.
Thus, the first chapter in the life of Thomas Kling ended, and he was wanted for jailbreak. Tom Kling has been wanted for 15 years. Wanted, but not found. For 15 years, he disappeared completely. No one knew where. Then, 15 years later, he came back. He came back holding a gun in a little bar in Bayonne, New Jersey.
My name is John Witko. I live at 523 Boulevard, Bayonne, New Jersey. I live right over Mr. Klimovich's bar. I was drinking there one night around 1:45 when a stranger entered the bar. At 2 o'clock, Mr. Klimovich ordered us out of the saloon. This stranger turned around and had a gun in his hand and claimed there was a stick-up. Mr. Klimovich said to him in Russian, "Shtuti, Durak," he says, "Are you crazy?" And before we knew what happened, Mr. Klimovich had hit him over the head. He had cracked his skull, and I believe he knocked out a few teeth and dropped him to the floor. I also jumped in to help, and before we knew what had happened, the stranger had left the place in a hurry.
The beaten gunman was identified as Thomas Kling, the same Thomas Kling who was still wanted in the Rahway escape of 15 years ago.
Then, on July 17, 1950, the FBI named Thomas Kling as one of the 10 most wanted fugitives in this country.
That incident is a very late chapter in the life of Thomas Kling. Now there's a problem. Here's a man who was wanted for jailbreak from Rahway Reformatory on a 5-year sentence and for a ridiculously unsuccessful attempted robbery of a small bar. And yet, the mightiest police force of a nation places him among the top 10 criminals at large. This seeming small-time punk occupies a spot in infamy held by such big-time bums as Dillinger, Pretty Boy Floyd, and Babyface Nelson. Why? Well, the clue lies in the 15 years during which Thomas Kling vanished from the face of the earth.
The date, September 6, 1939, 4 months after Kling cracked out of Rahway. The place, Bergen, New Jersey.
For reasons of my own, I prefer not to mention my name. On the morning of the holdup of the North Bergen Trust Company, I was standing at the cashier's window having my deposit counted when I heard a man say, "This is a stick-up." We were ordered to move to a room in the back of the bank. After we got into the room, a gunman told us to keep quiet and no one would get hurt. Naturally, everybody was very nervous and tense, and nobody did say anything. After a short while, these men walked out of the bank with the money, and I understand they got somewhere in the neighborhood of $20,000. They escaped in a 1933 DeSoto blue sedan.
My name is Vincent DeWitt. On the morning of the holdup, I had left my home, and as I reached the corner of 34th Street and Brightline Avenue, I attempted to turn east on 34th Street. As I did, a car caromed across the street at a terrific rate of speed, causing me to drag rubber. He gave me a nasty rip. He come across that street so blasted fast that he slammed a curb on the opposite side and come to a dead stop. As he come to a stop, I hopped out of my car, run up to his car, with the idea of asking him just what the idea was. As I approached this car, a hand came out of the back window. Some fellow in the back there reached out and slapped me across the mouth, and he really did slap me. In fact, he slapped me hard enough to knock me on flat on my back. This car started up, and I hopped in my car and proceeded after him. About halfway down the block, a fellow stepped out of the running board of this car and started firing at me with a gat. I didn't realize at that time he was firing at me. In fact, not till about 150 or 200 feet further on, when the back window of their car started to disappear, little holes began to appear in it. It seemed funny to me just to see them holes appear there. And at the same time, it seemed funny, too, when my windshield started to get little holes in it. One of my tires went flat, and I come to a complete stop. I'm glad I did. And I did not realize that these were the hold-up men that had held up the bank. In fact, I didn't realize it for the next 10 or 15 minutes until the cops came down and wanted to know what I was doing there. I didn't know myself. If I'd have known the bank was held up, I would have liked to have been about 100 miles away from that spot that morning.
As the bandits sped out of town with a hail of bullets, a crowd gathered back at the bank.
My name is Frank Linehan. I saw a lot of people down the street. I asked my brother what was wrong. And he said, the North Bergen Bank was just held up. So I walked down the street. And in front of the bank, there was a lot of people, and I heard them talking about the getaway car, travel at a high rate of speed. And I told my brother, I said, if that car traveled at a high rate of speed, I can find that car. Being sort of a speed maniac myself, I'd always left traction marks in the road. I'd look in the mirror behind me and see them. So I got in my car, and I picked up the traction marks of the getaway car. And I followed the traction marks through the streets, through the turns, right up to where the car was abandoned. And I rode back to the bank and reported what I found to Sergeant Keck.
This is Sergeant Edward Keck, North Bergen Police. Went to examine the car.
Notice that was a 1933 blue DeSoto four-door sedan. License number I-7473. Knew that this car was involved in the bank robbery. Ordered the car taken to police headquarters, where we dusted it for fingerprints and found two prints.
That first print belonged to a hoodlum known as Davelman. That second print was positively identified as belonging to a Georgie Moore.
Davelman and Moore were both well-known New York gang mobsters. Those two names were the tip-off that the Bergen job had been pulled by an organized gang. Half the police in the eastern area were on the lookout for this pair when news flashed out of Hawley, Pennsylvania. A second bank job.
My name is Thomas J. Oldfield, cashier of the Hawley Bank, Hawley, Pennsylvania. A man came in the bank and stopped at the desk. He kind of fussed around, looked a little bit suspicious, but we didn't think much of it. After which, another man came in, went over the window to Mr. Hauck, asked for some change. While he was getting it, I went around to the other side. I was going to get a card put up for the Federal Deposit Insurance. And I happened to look up, and I see this man standing there at the window, but didn't think anything of it. In the meantime, the other man had came over from the other window and stopped at the window. I went up to wait on him, and I was looking in a .45. Then another man came in. He came into the door, couldn't get in the door, climbed over the top, unlocked the door for the man that formerly held Mr. Hauck, and the two of them put the gun on Mr. Hauck and took what money there was in the drawer. Then they forced Mr. Hauck into the vault, took what money was in the vault, came out, after which the man that had me wished to know where he could lock us up. Wanted to lock us in the vault. I said, no, we would suffocate. So they decided to put us in the cellar, after which they left with $40,000 in cold cash, and away they went.
I'm Myron Skyer. I arrived at the Hawley Bank just as the bandits were speeding down the street in their car. As I went into the bank, the employees who were locked in the cellar informed me that the bank was stuck up. I had been down at Matter's Garage investigating an insurance loss with the aid of Chief Krause of Hawley and Trooper Koval of the Pennsylvania State Police. Knowing they were still there, I jumped in my car and went down to Matter's Garage and informed the police of the bank stick-up.
This is George T. Krause, Chief of Police of Hawley, Pennsylvania. When we were informed by Mr. Skyer that the Hawley Bank on Main Street had been held up and robbed, we immediately went to the bank to gain necessary information and commandeered cars to make a roadblock if possible, but later found that the bandits had made their escape. And in our search, we found the abandoned car, which had made the exact holdup at the bank, which was abandoned on Route 590, about a mile east of Hawley. But alongside of this car was tire marks of another car, which had evidently been there for to make the getaway and the transfer of their loot in.
There and then, that trail came to an end. Pennsylvania State Police put a Corporal Knight in charge of the investigation. Knight went to work looking for suspects. Meanwhile, Bergen, New Jersey had word of the Hawley job, and they sent Sergeant Keek to Hawley.
This is Sergeant Edward Keek of the North Bergen Police Again. When I arrived in Hawley, I contacted Corporal Knight of the Pennsylvania State Police and told him of my suspicions that the gang that had robbed the Hawley Bank were the same that had held up the North Bergen Trust Company. I gave up pictures with two suspects whose fingerprints had been lifted from the North Bergen getaway car, namely George Moore and Howard Davelman.
This is Robert Knight in the State Police. After the photographs of George Moore and Howard Davelman were given to me by Sergeant Keek, I took them to the Hawley Bank. The photograph of George Moore was positively identified by cashier C.S. Hauck. In view of the fact that there were five or six others who participated in this holdup, our investigation was continued in an effort to establish the identity of the other members of the gang. It was our opinion that the holdup and robbery of the bank was the execution of a well-conceived plan. The actual holdup in the bank was committed with timing and precision, and the flight of the gang from the scene of the crime indicated to us that they had a thorough knowledge of the roads and terrain in that district. From all this, we concluded that the gang must have had some local contact. Our job is to find that man.
Now, on the local level, Pennsylvania's Trooper Knight went to work, and he found a lead. Using New Jersey's pictures, he started asking every single man and woman in and around Hawley if they knew any of the faces they saw in the pictures. One person who, for his own protection, must remain nameless, picked out the picture of George Moore and, in all innocence, said,
"Don't tell me he's in jail."
That off-guard question implied knowledge of George Moore, and Moore was already identified as being part of the Bergen holdup gang. Pennsylvania's Trooper Knight settled down for a long siege with the informant. He worked until the full story came out.
Sure, the Holly job was cased by a local man. His name is Jake Watson. Watson and his girlfriend Mabel have only been in town a few months. He came up here to get a job as a stone crusher on the highways. He wasn't so interested in crushing stone as he was in the Holly banks. Yeah, from the first, he was amazed at a town with two banks and only one policeman. He used to go over to the banks all the time, just to look around. They looked like a snap. Well, he couldn't resist passing this information on to his New York pals. Them pals pulled the job.
Police problem. Who were the pals? There were five of them. The Holly informant named four of them. Only the fifth posed a problem. That fifth was the leader of the gang.
His name was Schwam or Scrab or Shrant, something like that. I can describe what he looks like, though.
Pennsylvania police came to New York, and with that as a lead, they went to work in the Rogues Gallery, looking at pictures. Looking for a man whose name was something like Schwam or Scrandon or Scrab. A man who fit the description given by the Holly informant.
They found him. His name was Schlechter, Eddie Schlechter, known to be a smart cookie. He fit the description perfectly.
His picture was taken back to the informant, and once again...
Sure, that's him. That's the leader.
I am William S. Secor, former member of the police department, City of New York, and the 18 Squad detectives. Now that we had the names of all the members of this mob, we decided to go out and round them up. Prior to going out on this particular roundup, we received good information that one of the mob was eliminated. As we received a phone call from the Polyclinic Hospital stating that a man was thrown from a speeding automobile riddled with bullets and thrown into the street. And before the doctors at this hospital could do anything for this body or man, he died. And later on, through fingerprints, it was ascertained that this particular body was one, Thomas Redmean, one of the mob. After learning and finding out this particular information, we decided then to go out and round up the whole mob before they entirely eliminated themselves.
New York police worked fast. First on the list, boss man Eddie Schlechter was picked up. Schlechter confessed and turned state's evidence. He gave the police the entire story. He was sort of proud of himself. You see,
Schlechter was the key man in a gang which was operating bank holdups like a big business, an organized business with a lot of departments. The car theft department, the bank casing department, the shooting department, the fingerman department, and the treasury department. Yeah, they even had a special department which manufactured bulletproof vests.
Eddie Schlechter explained the murder of Meehan. He said an organization such as his had personnel problems. They had to hire gun punks. Gun punks are irresponsible. Sometimes they shoot a guy. He admitted among the gun punks he'd hired was a guy named Arthur Walsh.
Arthur Walsh. Walsh was a new name to the police. They looked for his record and found he had none. No record, no past, no address, no nothing. Walsh was the only member of the entire operation who had no record. As a matter of fact, as far as the police could figure, Arthur Walsh didn't have a past. Once again, the police started a stalling action. Now, before they picked up the other members of the gang, they needed a lead to Walsh. They got it.
This is Detective James Sheehy, formerly of the West 47th Street Precinct, New York. Schlechter was the boss of the mob. He fingered one Herbie Miller. Miller was what we knew as the treasurer of Bank Robbers Incorporated. And believe me, they had plenty of money. We could have picked up Miller at that time, but decided instead to tap his wire. We heard many interesting conversations. Among them, we heard a telegram read from one Arthur Walsh in Miami, Florida, who was trying to get some money. That was our tip. We knew then that the mob was in Miami.
A tenuous lead to the mysterious Walsh. He was in Miami with three other members of the gang. Miami was alerted to be on the lookout. Miami moved fast and found them.
Police picked them up in a ritzy hotel in Miami Beach. They said they were down there for their health, and they were. It seems one of the members of the gang had caught bullet fever at the same time someone had knocked off Thomas Red Meehan. They took the boys in and held them for New York.
Now, New York police closed in on the remaining members of the gang. George Moore and Howard Gableman, whose fingerprints were found in the North Bergen getaway car. Then, New York police went to Holly and arrested the stone-crushing case artist, Jake Watson. Not to mention the treasurer of the gang, the unfortunate Herbie Miller of the Tapped Wires.
This is Detective James Sheehy, formerly of the West 47th Street Precinct in New York. We herded the whole gang together in police headquarters in New York, and Miller, the treasurer of the gang, is still trying to play the big shot. He wants to buy lunch for all the mob, and Captain Phillips says, well, that's okay with me. Miller takes out a $10 bill out of his pocket and says, here, buy the boys lunch. Captain Phillips examines the bill, and to our surprise, where do you think the bill came from? It was part of the loot stolen in the Hawley bank job.
Now, Bank Robbers Incorporated were in custody. They had a problem. They could plead guilty to the Hawley job and go to Pennsylvania for trial. Or they could plead not guilty and take their chances on a first-degree murder rap in the matter of the bullet-riddled body of Thomas Red Meehan.
They chose Pennsylvania.
Except for boss man Eddie Schlechter. He was too smart for either. He'd been a material help to the New York cops, and since he was the brains, he deserved respect. He never went to trial at all in the Hawley job.
But the others? All sent up. The heaviest sentences were for the gun punks. Guys like Arthur Walsh. 10 to 20 years in Eastern State Pen.
Arthur Walsh. A man who looked like the original tattooed man in the circus. The mysterious Arthur Walsh, who had no past, spent 13 years at Eastern State Pen. Then Arthur Walsh, because of good behavior, was paroled in 1947 and disappeared.
During a routine fingerprint check on the records, it was discovered that the tattooed man known as Arthur Walsh was in reality Thomas Kling, wanted for escape from Rahway Reformatory.
This was the same Tom Kling who learned how to operate with a big-time mob in the pen.
Now it was too late for police action. Tom Kling, alias Arthur Walsh, was free. Official circles had no report on his activities until the barroom brawl on December 27, 1949 in Bayonne, when he appeared with a gun.
I'm Lewis Smith, acting capital detective, Bayonne Police Department. When Thomas came from the penitentiary and returned to Bayonne, we felt we had a hot cookie on our hands and he needed to be watched. This barroom brawl, in which he lost two teeth and had a clump of hair gouged out of his head by being struck with a barroom stool, was a comedy. But Kling being no comedian and not interested in $18 stick-ups, we felt that he might have needed some money to get somewhere. We have reason to believe at the present time he is mixed up with some big-time mob.
That's the official story, but there's more to it than that, much more. Listen to the voice of the underworld.
Let me tell you something about this guy, Tom Kling. Everybody thinks he's just a two-penny gunman, a guy who sat in the can. But the word has it that he's Willie Sutton's partner. They even say that he was in on that bank job. You remember when Willie Sutton knocked off that bank in Long Island? And they know that if they want to get Sutton, they first got to get Kling, because Kling knows where he is. And if they pick this guy Kling up, he's going to lead them directly to Sutton. That's what makes this small-timer one of the most important guys to grab off right now.
It is not our function here to determine the guilt or innocence of a man, nor do we intend to. But according to the facts you've heard tonight and or other pertinent material, Thomas Kling is wanted. Wanted for armed robbery.
Here again is Walter McGraw.
You can help find Thomas Kling. Remember, you, the listener, have run up an impressive record with the apprehension of 3 of the 9 fugitives we've broadcast. But to bring Kling to justice, you must be informed of all the facts. What does he look like? How does he dress? What are his habits? These we will give you. So stand by. How can you recognize him? Listen. And listen carefully.
This is Robert O'Connor, Chief of Police, Bayonne, New Jersey. Wanted.
Thomas Kling, age 44, height 5 feet 6 inches, weight 124 pounds, hair brown, complexion fair, may have large scar on top of head, heavily tattooed on both arms and chest.
Now back to Walter McGraw in New York.
If you should see Kling, don't approach him on the street. Simply call your own local police department or the FBI. Give them the fullest possible information. If you have no other way of seeing a picture of Thomas Kling, go to your local post office. A poster with his picture is on the wall. Study that face.
Thomas Kling is a short man, 5 feet 5.5 inches tall. He weighs 124 pounds. He has brown hair, blue eyes, fair complexion. Outside of the circus, he is one of the most tattooed men in the country. He's a wise guy, politely defiant, a criminal by choice.
Tonight, you've heard the details on a man who's a criminal by choice, an accomplice of today's number one public enemy, Willie Sutton. As long as this pair is free, they will participate in various crimes around this country. According to information I've recently received, Kling may be hanging around the eastern waterfront. He may be working a racket down there, so longshoremen, merchant seamen, stevedores, this is your case. You can spot Thomas Kling and bring him to justice. You've brought in three fugitives, so let's do it again. Now, this is Walter McGraw saying, there's no time like now to wipe out crime.
Be with us again next week when you will hear the actual people give their eyewitness accounts of a psychopathic murderer who is wanted. Wanted for jailbreak. All material heard tonight was factual, from the record. Real names were used. No one was protected. Tonight's report was written by P.L. Mayer. Music was directed by Morris Mimorski. The narrator was Fred Collins. Wanted was supervised for NBC by Joel Hamill and produced and directed by Walter McGraw. Sunday, hear Charlie Wilde, Private Eye, and The Falcon on NBC.